Thank you, Doug.
Thank you, Jim. Pleased to be here, and hopefully my voice will hold up for the duration of this. I managed to get a good cold coming out here to Pittsburgh, but as Jim indicated, we're going to talk today about using soil quality as an indicator for sustainable feedstock production. And there's many, many people that have contributed to this work. The actual study itself, Stuart Burrell is my agriculture biosystem engineering colleague from Iowa State that has worked on the single pass harvesting system and is a big part of the current work that we're doing where we're actually applying soil quality to the feedstock removal strategies. We'll start out today with a brief review of the soil quality concept, some of the indicators affected by feedstock harvest, looking at soil carbon as a crucial indicator for the soil quality assessment, the SMAF, Soil Management Assessment Framework. It's a tool that we've put together over the past couple of decades to look at a number of different soil quality indicators and use it then as an index for assessing the sustainability of management systems, of which feedstock removal is one of those that's currently under investigation. And of course, the bottom line, you want to see, well, how do you go about doing this? I will also walk you through how we have, on this feedstock removal site near Ames, establish the baseline for soil quality assessment because it is long-term. Soils change slowly, as we're all aware. So therefore, you have to know where you are at this point in time in order to assess where you get eventually with different management strategies. Our soil quality is, how does a soil function? Or in this application to the feedstocks, we're looking at it as a goal-dependent assessment protocol for evaluating its evaluating soil resource response to the use being removal of lignocellulosic feedstocks. The management goals that we have, that we impose on our system, will dictate which of the soil functions are most critical. Soil quality recognizes the multitude of soil functions, the multitude of physical, chemical, and biological properties and processes that are affected by the decisions we make. And then it's a selection of those functions that are critical that determine which indicators one chooses to use for the assessment. The indicators we choose, as Andrew pointed out before, they need to correlate well with all ecosystem functions. They need to integrate the soil physical, the chemical, the biological properties and processes. Accessible to many users and sensitive to management and climate. And hopefully readily available through databases, through building databases, to cross-reference current measurements to where we expect to be. And as you can see, those indicator guidelines are back from 1996, already in the early stages of soil quality assessment. So we're now applying this as a tool to the feedstock harvest scenarios. Up in the upper right-hand corner shows the single-pass system that Stuart and I are working on to do differential harvest of crop residues. It's a system whereby you can take off, depending on cutting height, nearly all the available residue plus the grain, or you can raise the cutting height and leave it at different heights, as exemplified by some of those other pictures you see there with different stubble heights. But there are other indicators that have to be looked at: the runoff impact, the compaction impact, the erosion impact, the trace gas impact, and of course the leaching impact, just to name five of the different potential areas. All of these different potential indicator areas will have critical functions associated with them. So all of these functions then you have to determine based on where you're at in the land area, which are going to be the critical indicators one uses for this assessment. The REAP team, which, as Jim pointed out, is a multi-location effort at some 25 locations around the country now with many different people participating in it. The mantra, really, for a lot of our work coming at it as predominantly soil scientists, is the soil carbon as a barometer. This is a figure you'll see in many of our presentations, simply because you can go any place in the world and you've got a pre-cultivation steady state level of soil carbon. That's why there is no units on that left axis. But you've got a level. When you initiate agriculture through drainage, through tillage, through management, through manipulation of those soil resources, you have the oxidative processes, and over a period of anywhere from 25 to 100 years, you always will show you're dropping that soil carbon from that native level to somewhere around 50%. This is where we were at with the equilibrium we're rocking along with our current production systems. If we now, with the need for residues, for biofuel, in addition to the feed, fiber, and food production interests, if we pull additional residues off, it's like going to the bank and pulling additional principal out. You're going to drop down if you don't do mitigating practices of incorporating cover crops, green manures, increased efficiencies, or innovative technologies, all of these into that to adjust to that soil carbon balance. And the reason it's so important is because that soil carbon as that indicator in the soil quality, that soil carbon is affecting several different processes: the structure, the rooting, the nutrient cycling, the water retention. All of these aspects are part of the factors that are being affected by that soil carbon it's in the soil. Now, let's start to apply some of the principles of soil quality to the feedstock removal issue. One of the easiest ones for producers to get a handle on is, of course, is productivity. It's the one we fall back on because we can see it the most easily. In the study, the first 4 years of the work that Stuart and I have been doing on the feedstock and its impact on soil quality, obviously we have the continuous corn, rotated corn crops. It's a whole other area of work and another presentation that if I had a voice I could talk to you about. But in this study, we're once again showing the continuous corn is coming out lower yielding, lower stover production than the rotated corn. So in feedstocks, that, you know, that in terms of a cold cropping system set of interactions there that are being shown again. Some of those factors along the side are just the different stereo. It's what we're doing in terms of our residue harvest. But I use this slide just to illustrate the point that we are looking at the two cropping systems. Andrew mentioned earlier about the increased nutrient removal associated with removing the feedstocks. This was one of the first things that we recognized when we sort of went back into this lignocellulosic area of feedstock production. My career began in Florence, South Carolina, with the first time we were on the bioenergy questions, and we were taking off corn stover, winter cover crops, etc., and looking at the fertility status primarily. When they asked about doing this again in 2005, and at that point they were giving a very low value to what they were going to give for the residues because it was being considered a waste in some camps, my first reaction was, have you even thought about the nutrient removal? And sort of blank stares, well, the answer was no. But this is just your macronutrients alone here on the continuous corn crop. You can see about 30 to 35 kilograms per hectare of the N and the K, and about a tenth of that in the phosphorus removal. And if you go to the rotated corn with the higher stover yield, you're up there about 40 kilograms per hectare on the N and K. And again, about a tenth of that in phosphorus. The paper I did yesterday for the REAP team across the nation, we were up in that same ballpark there from 8 locations. So it's consistent around the country in the amount of NPK you're removing. You add those all together and you take the 2009 fertilizer prices and you're dealing with about $15 a megagram for the stover just in nutrient replacement costs. So you've got that factor. That's an indicator it's not exactly soil quality per se, but it's part of the system that you have to be cognizant of it as an endpoint. This is really where we got into the soil quality impact of the Stover removal. On that site, we had the rotated corn site in 2005. We pulled off there under that whole plant level, so over 7 megagrams per hectare of the Stover. Very good yielding corn that year. We grew soybean in 2006. And quite frankly, I was shocked when the data came in that my soybean yield was 50% of what it was where the Stover did not come off. I suspected potential nutrient problems, but I didn't expect it to drop by half. We had fortunately pulled soil samples following the 05 harvest. I just hadn't got them analyzed prior to the 06 data. And what it turned out on this site was, as you can see there, the rotated site over there is on a Clarion Nicolet Webster hilltop area, about 1.9% organic matter, 19 grams per kilogram organic matter, typical of what you find in the areas in the on the Des Moines lobe, on the hilltop areas. The continuous corn site is on a Webster Canisteo area there, so it's lower, and that's why the organic matter is higher. pH was okay, but if you look at that malic extractable P and K, we are on low fertility areas. This occurred because DOE had come to us late in August asking us to do these bioresidue removal studies, and so we had to implement a study. You usually don't start corn studies in Iowa in August, but this is the way that research began, so we had taken the site. Maybe the way a farmer might go into if he was put under, somebody came to them and offered them a chance to market some residues and they were strapped for cash. So they did it, and they didn't think about long-term implications. So this was the real key, that hey, soils are going to have an impact. They might have a really big impact if we don't watch our assessment protocols here. So what's needed to assess soil quality? Well, you need tools that are accurate, simple to use, meaningful, and you need site-specific standards and guidelines for their interpretation. This is where our work with the soil management assessment framework is being able to be implemented. Obviously, the management goals in this case are to produce a viable amount of lignocellulosic feedstocks and protect the soil and have economic yields, and so you have critical soil functions that lead to the indicators that you choose. That whole indicator suite is called the minimum data set, and then you have to score those. Then you can look at those indicators either individually or collectively as an overall index value. So I'll show you how we work through that. That whole soil management assessment framework, we've developed that through Susan Andrews, was a key counterpart in this. Susan now is with NRCS and heads the soil quality team for the NRCS out of Greensboro, North Carolina. We've got a version 4, Diane Stott, Brian Weinhold, others have contributed all this, that has 14 potential indicators for which scoring functions have been developed. This includes total organic carbon, macroaggregate levels, microbial biomass carbon, potential mineralizable N, pH, phosphorus, potassium, bulk density, electrical conductivity, sodium absorption ratio, available water, beta-glucosidase to reflect some of the soil enzyme activities, water-filled pore space, and QCO2. When soil quality was evolving, we had some 50 or 60 or more different potential indicators. SMAF just has 14 now because that's the 14 that people have taken time to develop scoring functions for. So that's why we've got it at 14. There's still a lot of other ones that can be added to this. And the framework is simplistic that you can use as many or as few as is appropriate. The general guidelines we try to do, though, are to make sure you have something that represents the chemical, the physical, and the biological processes and properties that are occurring. For our data set, we use total organic carbon, macroaggregation pH, microbial biomass carbon, potentially mineralizable nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. to set the baseline for this bioenergy site, then we have two fields and five historical tillage practices. The soil quality assessment plan includes profile sampling. You always want to look to, generally, if you can, and this is going to vary depending on region of country, but generally to a depth of at least a meter. Look at the near surface, and that's 0 to 5, 5 to 15, 15 to 30 centimeter increments, the real active root zone. Sometimes you want to divide it a little bit differently. But again, a little bit deeper, 30 to 60, 60 to 100. As I said, these are the minimum data set that we had. It's generally the organic carbon, the nitrogen, soil test, P and K, the bulk density situation. Other analyses that are typical, the ag stability, the palm carbon, secondary and micronutrients, enzymes, nitrate, etc. This shows you then on our two fields that we have where we're going in and setting this baseline. This is really the precursor for a whole other area of discussion. The site was in 35 years of either continuous corn or corn-soybean rotation and different tillage treatments. But we went out and we got these different indicators for the different treatments there. And I'm sharing this with you, just kind of showing you the process today as how we're going through the soil quality assessment. And you can see the different measurements that were made there, this field 70 being the continuous corn one. Probably the consistency factor is that the plow one had that low level of soil organic matter. This is in the 0 to 15 centimeter depth. So obviously a lot of times you'll find studies when you do moldboard plowing, you'll push that carbon down a little bit deeper. And so when I do the full profile analysis, we may show where that is. But the bottom, what I'm trying to get across is where the getting the collected set of data for the continuous corn field, and then this is the rotated field. But there's not a lot of difference between these after the 35 years of those two treatments. We then take that information, and we, in order to use the soil quality assessment, you go through that from that framework there for the scoring functions. This illustrates one of the curves that help people understand the assessment because with something like organic matter or total organic carbon, if you've got a different soil type, you've got different ranges there that are going to be used to give you that conversion of where you're at on the level of organic matter that compared to what you expect. If you're in a southeastern altisol, if you had 2% soil organic matter, you'd have a soil that would be as good as you could possibly get. But if you were at 2% organic matter in the Midwest, you're going to have a low scoring soil. That idea is you can use the same protocol, but because you score them tailored to the inherent characteristics of your soil, it becomes a legitimate way to compare it. You're not going about the business of comparing altisols and malasols. You're using this information ultimately to evaluate your on-site management impacts of practices such as the stover removal. Phosphorus is another one, just an example. There we had the ascending portion of the curve is the plant nutrition response, but then depending on slope and other aspects, you're going to have a decrease in score if your soil test values get too high, because you're then moving over to having the potential to have a negative environmental impact from increased soluble phosphorus, increased runoff, and those things. That's a couple examples that are in the black box behind the soil quality assessment process. So then going back and looking at some of that data that we had there, you can see that total organic carbon and the potassium ranged in the vicinity. Well, those are the two of the that were the lowest relative to what we would expect for that soil. And there were some differences amongst the different tillage systems there. But I'm just not really emphasizing that today, but just wanting to compare that. in a similar pattern for the field 71, or if we get over here to really what's where you can look at it together, we see that when we went into the removal aspects at this site, the two fields that were brought together, they had a different long-term history, but then we manipulated them with a year off in between where they were completely tilled, they were cropped to an oat crop, and sort of tried to bring back into a somewhat consistency. But relative to at least the overall soil quality rating, when the removal treatments were begun, we're at a common point of about 0.8485. Now, this is how that will be used in terms of then looking at where those Stover removal treatments are coming in. We will know where we're at that baseline level. So in 3 to 5 year periods, you go back in and you measure those indicators again. You score them once again. And then soil quality and the impact of your management systems becomes one of, am I moving then from having where I established that baseline to a degrading condition? Hopefully not. Or at least sustaining it. Or ideally, with appropriate management practices, you could actually be, enhancing your soil with, say, with cover crops, with other biochar or other applications in the whole system. So the whole idea behind using soil quality as an indicator for sustainable biofuel feedstock production is to use it as a tool to establish where your baseline is, to look at physical, chemical, biological properties and processes, and then to begin to build your data sets and then move forward and have it as a barometer to work from. So in conclusion, the indicators can be used to monitor the sustainability of biofuel feedstock. The SMAF is relatively easy to use. It's been tried for a number of different studies, both in the U.S., long-term cropping studies, long-term types of applications. It consistently comes up with a message that makes sense to both in people and farmers and users that, yes, this is what I am seeing in the soil situation. And so it's what I consider a logical assessment protocol. And in this particular case, the two indicators that stood out and flagged us most for getting started as the baseline into where we're doing the removal work was the soil carbon and the soil test potassium situation. Again, I apologize for my terrible voice, but be glad to entertain any questions that you might have that I haven't been able to explain. The number of indicators, soil quality has been, as you're probably aware, one of those controversial topics, and it's just a matter of people and resources to move forward and to build from the literature appropriate scoring functions for these. The initial version of SMAF had 11 indicators. Just recently, Brian Weinhold and some of the rest of us had a paper that added three more, the water-filled pore space, the potassium, and the beta-glucosidase. It's just a matter of time and energy. Probably about a decade ago, in working in the soil quality assessment, I was rather frustrated in how do I get this picked up? How do I get it moved forward? And it suddenly dawned on me that when Walt Wischmeyer and others working on the original USLE equations started, they had no idea of where that whole erosion technology would go over the next 50 to 75 years. That's the way I feel about the SMAF. It's going to take a lot of creative energy. There's many, many, many opportunities out there to improve it. We've always maintained that if there's a better mousetrap, it'll get it put into the SMAF, and it's just a matter of the reason it got cut down is nobody had the time or energy to build another curb. And back there.
Thanks. I'm a little bit surprised that you put so much weight on soil organic carbon, actually, because it's an indicator for sure, but it's very slow to move. Well, I would have thought linking it with microbial biomass, where you lock up the ratio of biomass to organic matter, is a much more sensitive indicator than either of them on their own. Why haven't you adopted that one?
Time to explore it. We're collecting a lot of microbial biomass data, and probably my biggest challenge has been figuring out how I'm going to interpret it.
We use it a lot. We call it an early warning because it does change much more quickly and more readily than soil organic matter. It's like kicking an elephant.
Right, and the particulate organic matter carbon is one of the fraction ones that we've also measured as a potential one to see that move faster. But I would agree totally. It's a matter of human hours to get the right interpretations.
Mouth button that goes back to the main screen.
Go back to this, and then you'll just click right here. Just to load.